Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So this gathering has been organized by the Ottawa Buddhist Society, and it's kind of a continuation of some of the Upasika program we had last year. We didn't continue it here because we didn't have a venue, but now we have the tent, which we're working on. So I'm quite pleased that the OBS has made this initiative that we can come together and think about Dhamma. This tent is an ongoing project. Our idea here is to try to use this for about 5 years until we get a meditation hall built, and that's of course very unknown how that will work out. But we have a floor and we have a sound system. The topic which the OBS asked me to reflect upon is right effort, and right effort is in the context of the Noble Eightfold Path. And I don't know, most of you probably have a background around the Four Noble Truths, but one needs to always emphasize that. So that what we have from tradition and legend is that the first teaching the Buddha offered was a way of contemplating the conflicts we have, both in ourselves and others, and actually using those very conflicts for the end of conflict. Using the very difficulties we have as a way of understanding ourselves, and then going beyond the limitations that we place upon ourselves through non-understanding. And when we think about right effort, we're here sitting in this tent hall, and the perception for me is loud and hot. I'm sure for you it's silent and cool, but perhaps for most of us it's loud and hot. That's the initial perception. Now, what do I need to do to make that suffering? Put it the other way around. We usually talk about how to put an end to suffering. Put it the other way around. What do I need to do while I'm sitting here to make this a problem? When does it become suffering? Well, it becomes suffering if it's dangerous. So if it's so hot that someone's going to have a heart attack, probably better to go have a swim. It's so loud that I'm losing my hearing. It's a million decibels, and you know, better get out of here. So that's just very natural to get out of suffering when it's harmful. Otherwise we wouldn't be intelligent at all. Now, it would be much nicer to go to Denny's Cottage and have a swim. That's Denny there. Or Anne's Cottage. It's down Pike Lake. So we could... I'll go there after, be careful. Pile into your cottage. We could go there, and we will go there probably, you know, in our different... possibilities. We'll have a swim this summer. And just think about like being in a cool lake. You can swim. It's helpful. It's hot outside. You feel refreshed. You feel invigorated. You feel peaceful. So that's environmentally, situation-wise, creates a sense of pleasure. And we'll all do that. That's natural. It's not that we have to seek out displeasure. Yeah, please take the water. It's a good idea so we don't get dehydrated. But sitting in this room now, it's a kind of, for me, it's essentially unpleasant as opposed to going to the lake, right? Get this damn water out. Good little bit. Step over here, Dharma.
Dick!
Okay, you with me? So, like, in this situation, sitting here, and the sound of the fan gets hot. Now, to my sense perception of that, that's unpleasant. It's not pleasant. But that's not suffering, is it? It's not suffering. It becomes suffering when, what do I have to do to make this suffering? Well, I'd have to first of all react to the sound in a way where I wouldn't want it. And to do that, and to suffer, I'd have to reinforce the not wanting. I'd be sitting here and there's the sound pa, 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 going around. I'd have to perceive that as too loud. This is too loud. And then I would have to reinforce that with thinking. I might think, why didn't you get a quieter fan? Or why didn't he put the fan somewhere else? Or I don't want to be here. So to suffer, I'd have to put forth effort. Now, I might not notice that effort. It might be so habitual, maybe my mind very easily goes into aversion, but I still have to think that way. I'd have to follow that perception, that train of thought. The heat, same thing. You feel the heat, and the heat is, to me, it was unpleasant, but it wasn't suffering. When does it become suffering? I'd have to think, I want to be in the lake. I don't want to be here. It's too hot. We shouldn't have been here. We should be outside. I have to reinforce the perception that it's too hot. So that would take effort. Again, if my mind was very much inclined to aversion and a lack of gratitude or whatever, then it would easily run that way, but I'd still have to constantly think in that way. So that would require effort, but obviously that would not be right effort. We would say that wrong effort, because it leads to suffering. Let's say that I'm a pianist. I love piano, and I'm not a pianist, but it's for example's sake. And there's a very renowned international pianist coming to Ottawa. And very hard to get tickets. I get 2 tickets. And I've wanted to hear this pianist for a long, long time. And I have a friend. I want to impress the friend, too. So I go to the concert, and the heating system, the ventilation system is kaput in the concert hall, and I get this heat. And the sound system is producing this sound, and I've come to listen to the piano, right? Now, it's the same sound, it's the same heat, but now I've upped the ante. And how have I upped the ante? I have an expectation. I paid my money, I want to impress the friend, and I've wanted to hear this pianist for 10 years. We're really, you know, really up the ante now. So what is there? This expectation. There's expectation for the world to be a certain way. And certainly the person, I would be in my rights to demand my ticket back and my money back, consumer rights and all that. But why would I suffer? Why would that be suffering? Because I attach to the expectation. And everyone would agree with me. You darn, you know, you're right. I mean, it's ridiculous, you shouldn't. But the suffering would be my problem. But right effort there would be much more difficult. Much, much more difficult. Because now I'm listening with this huge backlog of expectation. And not only is there the sound of the fan, but the sound of the fan is interrupting what I want to hear. I want to hear the piano, I want to hear the notes. And the heat is putting me to sleep. I can't even stay awake to hear this piano. So now it's very compounded. But in the same way, to suffer, I would have to reinforce that expectation. It'd be much easier to reinforce that expectation. It'd be very hard not to reinforce that. But I still have to make the effort. I'd have to pursue that expectation with thought. With that, you know, I have to reinforce it, and that would cause suffering. So in both cases, I have to make effort not to suffer, but the effort would depend, wouldn't it? It would depend on the whole situation, the context, and so on. So as I often say, my first teacher in Buddhism, a monk in an American monk in India, he would say, what word would the Buddha most use if he were around? What word do you think he'd most use? And my friend would always say, it depends. And it's true, isn't it? So when we say right effort, it depends. So it's not some kind of dogmatic. I mean, when we use the word right, it can sound kind of dogmatic, but it's not. It's just right is right in accordance with the end of suffering and the causes of suffering. So what are the causes and conditions now that I can make and do and participate in, which will be give results for now, peace for now, and peace in the future? What are the causes and conditions? So I might not feel peaceful now, but I can make efforts so the cause and conditions now create peace in the future. So maybe I'm in the concert and I'm listening to and not hearing this music and half hearing it, getting totally frustrated. As a contemplative, I would say, ah, frustration feels this way. I would awaken to the fact that I'm ticked off, that I'm annoyed, that I'm getting ripped off, or whatever perception came to the mind, I would awaken to that so there wouldn't just be the external situation, but there would be the internal reaction. And that awakening to the way things are is the sort of primary function of right effort, the primary doing of right effort, awakening to the way things are, which is not a judgment. It's not a judgment that I shouldn't feel resentful that I can't hear the sound. It's not that. It's a total coming to full consciousness of what is going on right now, what's sort of going on in my mind and in my life. And you could see that if I did that in the concert or here, then I would begin to be able to understand my suffering. I could see how I'm creating something around this situation that's my own mind, that's my own conditioning. If I never came to that awakening, I could never be free. So right effort in Buddhism is always predicated on right understanding. And right understanding conditions right intention, or right thought. If I awaken then, like just during the sitting, personally, you know, you're all meditators, you're probably doing the same thing. First of all, what do? I make an effort to notice the way things are. You know, that's not a big deal, but quite often we don't notice the way things are because we're lost in past and future. So present moment awareness is a part of right effort. Present moment awakening. This is the way it is now. I mean, and that's the refrain you're going to get till you die in Buddhism. This is the way it is now. And it is amazing how we can hear that again and again and again, and we just don't notice the way things are. We already reacted. So returning to that, but this is the way it is now. It's hot and there's sound. And then from that, through your reflections on the Four Noble Truths, okay, I feel discontent. I feel some kind of discontent going on now. What is it? Well, you know, what does that discontent feel like? So I'm mindful now, and I'm using the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's the end of suffering, and there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. I'm using that teaching now, not just as a belief or a kind of scriptural truism that we all bark out in Buddhism, but I'm actually using it as a tool of perception. And for me, this is very important, that Buddhist teaching offers ways of interpreting, perceiving, and looking at life which free you. But you have to do it, don't you? You have to actually employ this sort of avenue of observing and keep applying it until you say, oh, yeah, that's where my problem is. That's where I'm attached, or that's why there is suffering. So, let's take the example back to the concert. You're back at the concert, and first of all, it'd be very difficult not to blame someone, because that would be the easiest thing to do, right? And this is what we do. You're disappointed by something, and then rather than take responsibility for the disappointment, one looks for a target, and that's called aversion. And it feels really good to hate someone, doesn't it? You know, it releases a bit of energy, and you feel self-righteous, and everyone agrees with you, and you go home. But you're still a victim. You've still been done, right? So on a social level, on a conventional level, certainly one goes and gets one money back for the ticket. That's not wrong. Or one complains to the management, hey, you know, this is not on. But the aversion, one has to take responsibility for that, right? Because if you don't, then the next time you get disappointed, what happens? The tendency to aversion now has been reinforced. So not only do I feel aversion now, but I create the causes and conditions for aversion in the future. That's called karma, or vipaka kamma. The accumulated consequences of my intentions is what I become in the future. So, in Buddhism, be careful. Be careful. You know, it all counts. So I'm in the concert hall, and listening to this music, and now I have made a really deep commitment to the end of suffering, deeper than my love of music. Right? I make that my primary thing, the end of suffering. Music, no music. I mean, that's my primary aim now. If it is, then whenever suffering comes up, that kind of contemplative, reflective part of my being is activated now. Ah, there's suffering. Because why? Because I've done it many, many times, and this is practice. Many, many times I've suffered during a meditation, or gotten frustrated with my children, or became annoyed at the government, whatever it is, or got afraid of my body. Many, many times I've suffered, and many, many times I've taken on responsibility. And this is the idea of accumulated virtue. When we do things in a virtuous and good and wholesome and skillful way, that has an accumulated power. And vice versa, when we've unfortunately got caught up in that last example with, say, aversion, we have to face the accumulated consequences of that, which we call vipaka karma, or resultant karma. So, as practitioners, we always have this sort of battle going on, you could say. You know, we have the energy of deluded habits and deluded intentions and wrong understandings, which lead to suffering. And we have the skillful, wholesome, wise investments we've made coming forth and giving us power and strength to be free from suffering. So sometimes things click in real easy. You've seen yourself get averse to a situation, and you say, I'm not going there. I'm just not interested. I've suffered, 30 years of that. Well, no thanks. And you do it. You do it without repression. You just know that's not the path to go, and you move away. But other times you get blindsided. Something happens, you get cheated, and you're just like not expecting this, and you really get a hit of suffering. And your mind runs off into depression or fear or whatever. So the intensity of these things, it depends. It depends. So not to judge that, not to judge the intensity of your suffering as being right or wrong. It is what it is, according to causes and conditions. And that's what quite often we do. We we judge ourselves as being wrong for feeling intensely angry or intensely embarrassed or fearful or whatever, but that you can't do much about, can you? You're not like asking in the morning, I'm going to get intensely angry in the afternoon. You don't do that. You just get intensely angry. Right? So a sense of compassion and reasonableness around this is very, very helpful. And so the clarity of intention is important. So we say right understanding leads to right intention or right thought, which leads to right effort. And all efforts are based on intention. You have to intend to do it. Even the thinking of angry thoughts is intentional. I might not notice it. I might not be aware of it, but it's still an intentional act. So with intentionality is then built on my understanding of life. If my understanding of life is wrong, then I'm going to make intentions which are based upon wrongness or ignorance, not understanding the way things are. When I make the ground intention and the ground effort one of awakening to the way things are, I make that the kind of root practice always, that's coming from right understanding. Not just from like the monk is telling me to be mindful, so I force myself to be mindful. It comes from an understanding that the only way I'm going to really understand myself and my suffering is by looking and observing the way things are. It's the only way this knot's going to be unraveled. Rather than judging, trying to get rid of, and all that kind of business. So one of the difficulties we face in right effort and right understanding is that we quickly prejudge ourselves. We make a very quick judgment, I shouldn't be that way. I should be some other way. And that's not mindful. That's not right effort. That's coming from another kind of habitual pattern. Accumulated virtue. We're sitting in the room. It's hot and noisy, maybe. And we're constantly awakening to the effect of the heat and the effect of the sound on our minds. We're constantly awakening to that. That's the effect. And you notice after a while, it's just, it's just stuff. It's not suffering. It's just stuff. Now, there's a strength to that, which is deeper than the joy of going for a swim. The joy of going swimming is important too. It's not. We are in Ontario, so we have these opportunities, and we're not in Saudi Arabia. So, but there's something profoundly strengthening about being with the unpleasant. Not as self-mortification, not like getting on a bed of nails and saying, "Oh, this is great." Not in that way, but just the natural events of life present to us all manner of unpleasantness. It's a design fault, I know, I'm sorry, but there you go, it is that way, right? So as much as I have tried, and very mechanical tried, to make this the perfect environment for meditation within a limited budget, this is the way it is now, right? So all the intentions I make are limited by what? By nature. Nature has its own agenda, which sometimes my agenda kind of gets in line with, but I think, well, I better make my agenda in line with nature rather than just my desires. So I have a desire to create a nice environment for meditation, and then, well, it's good enough. This is what we've got. It's good enough. And that's one of the reflections that we as monks are asked to do all the time. This is the way it is now, and to be content with little. Now, what happens if you do that? You doesn't mean you become passive, but you begin to just take life as it presents itself, and you make the effort to bring forth that contemplation. Oh, it's good enough. I'm not dying. I'll make it. It'll be all right. And this is the way it is now. Now, that suggestion to the mind is an intention, right? That's an intention. It's a way of being with the present moment. And if it is done again and again and again and again and again and again for 40 years or 20 years or 10 years, it's different than consumerism. So consumerism is saying, do not be content with little. Get the latest update. Get the latest upgrade, right? So consumer society, and we are consumers, whether we have money or not, I don't have money, but we do consume things, consume ideas and so on. But consumption is this constant getting of experience. Right? It's not wrong. But being content with little is a piece of coexistence with this experience. So what happens if we sit for 45 minutes in a situation which is not threatening, which is not bad, which is not really painful, just somewhat unpleasant, and we bear with the unpleasantness for 45 minutes. We bear witness to, it's sticky and, it'd be nice to go elsewhere. But we just bear with it. We develop accumulated virtue. We have a virtuous attitude. I don't know, virtue, you don't use that word much. You find it in text. Skillful, say, wholesome. A skillful and wholesome mindset now, type of mind, which we are sustaining for 45 minutes. And that is the cause for peace in the future. Because in the future, I will come up with fans and heat, right? Inevitable, in all kinds of ways, in human relationships, in the aging of the body, and so on and so forth. I'll come up to the unpleasant constantly. But now, because I've made effort to sustain the skillful and the wholesome for 45 minutes, my mind has a power, a strength to be with the unpleasant, the unwholesome. And that plays out the next time something is unpleasant, unwholesome. It's not necessarily consciously done. It's the equipment, it's the strength, it's there already because it's accumulated virtue, accumulated goodness. So in terms of the sort of classical definitions of right effort, the way it's classically defined is there's the effort on the positive side and the effort on the negative side. And the effort on the positive side, as you probably have studied, but the effort on the positive side is to maintain the skillful and wholesome that have already arisen, the skillful qualities and wholesome qualities that have already arisen. And on the positive side, those which have not yet arisen, those skillful, wholesome qualities which have not yet arisen, to make them arise, to make them come up into conscious, to make them strong. And on the unwholesome, unskillful side, those skillful, unskillful, unwholesome, ignorant kind of suffering types of states and situations and mental states and so on that have arisen, to abandon them, and those which have not yet arisen to prevent them from arising. So it's around wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful. So let's say that you have a good meditation practice. You've worked hard to get some self-discipline going, and you do a 45-minute sitting every day, or half an hour, say. And you know it works for you. And then life gets stressful and busy, and 45 goes down to 43. Goes down to 40. Goes down to 20. And then you're vegging out in front of the television for 45 minutes. Because it's just easier to do. And it's interesting, I've talked to people about that. Why is vegging out in front of the television so relaxing? It seems to be, I don't know. Anyway, that's what you do. Well, you've lost a really skillful quality, the ability to meditate for 45 minutes, and you've not sustained it, and now you have to go on retreat to get back there. Right? So you see you see yourself kind of, it doesn't really matter. It matters. Oh, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll do it today. And that's discipline, self-discipline. And we all know that. We all know that. We all see that. And that's something we're always doing. We're always looking at whether it's training the body or training the mind or training in a craft or whatever skill we see, we have the capacity to be disciplined. And to do disciplines which bring really beautiful results and bring really profitable results. And we want to sustain those. And so that's the sustaining of the wholesome. Bringing forth wholesome things which have not arisen, maybe. that comes through your readings, through your interactions with people. Maybe you see someone suggest to you, have you ever done metta practice, say? Like, that's the first time we came across the practices of loving kindness. Think about that. And, no, I never thought of that. And someone says, well, why don't you just go to your heart and think, may all beings be free from suffering. Just do that for 10 minutes with your breath. And then, you know, that's interesting. I'll try that. And you do it. And all of a sudden you find something which is really, really fruitful. And then you have to sustain that. And that, our spiritual life is that all the time. I think we're always discovering just new gambits and new bits of practice that become meaningful in our own time. So this means study or interaction, hearing tapes, talking to people, whatever it is. And if you get an intuition, and that sounds interesting, go for it. There's something that touches you about a practice or an interpretation of the Dhamma that you think is going to be helpful. Try to make it become conscious. Make it become conscious so that your skill set or the tools that you use become more and more significant. So for me, the last year, I've been doing a lot of akasa meditation, space meditation, something that I've done on and off, but I haven't done consistently. And that's one of the things that Ajahn Sumedho is very, very strong in, is akasa. So contemplating, like, and the way I talk about it is this is happening in awareness. So awareness as space, rather than me being focused on an object. I've been doing that for the last year. That's very, it's kind of subtle for me because I can focus on objects, but noticing space is more subtle for me. And it's been a very, very interesting exploration, but it's taken some doing. Right? But they're very profitable, very, very useful now. And then those skillful meditations which I already do, I try to keep to those because I know how useful they are. So there's skillfulness in meditation technique. But there's also skillfulness in morality, of course. So when we talk about abandoning the unwholesome, there's a lot of teaching around living a life of non-harm. So, you know, not harming other creatures, not harming sentient beings, not harming the property or stealing, not harming beings with sexual relationships which are unkind and exploitive, honoring, being having fidelity in relationships, you know, using language which brings harmony rather than disharmony. So when we talk about right effort, we talk about effort in terms of bodily action, effort in terms of speech, and effort in terms of mental action. Because each time I make an intention, that's considered effort. That's considered effort. So each mind moment in Buddhist psychology has intentionality in it. I might notice it. I might be daydreaming, thinking about something else, but still, moment by moment, my mind is pursuing something pleasant. So let's say I'm sitting listening to a Dharma talk in a hot hall and I feel bored and my mind brings up the thought of a canoe trip in Algonquin. Right? You know, that oh, that's a nice thought. You know, and I go off with the fairies. I'm canoeing in Algonquin and so on. Each moment of pleasure that I mentally involved in is a moment of intention. It's not immoral. It's not wrong to do that, but there's a consequence of that. And the consequence of that is that the mind is always seeking objects of pleasure and not being able to be with objects of displeasure or neutrality. So there's right effort around the body, right effort around speech, right effort around the mind. So around the body, it is, you know, basically around our responsibilities as moral beings and social beings. How can I live in this world and not harm others? Not be a nuisance to this planet, as Ajahn Sumedho said. And with speech which is truthful, speech which is harmonious, speech which is appropriate, and that is a very difficult right effort, isn't it? The speech is so quick. And I've noticed so often with us monks, you know, we'd be joking around, and then someone gets nailed. Oh, and everyone goes silent. Oops. went too far. Speech was cruel. Humor was cruel. It was unkind, you know, and everyone feels, yeah, be careful. Try to do it better next time. Right? Or exaggeration. Manipulation, not gross, or just, you know, trying to get something from someone, or trying to look impressed, or all kinds of ways where we use speech which is coming from a place which is not pure, which is not wholesome, and then they give unwholesome results. And so quite often where we notice wrong effort is in the consequences of wrong effort. And we look, oh, yeah, that was that regret and remorse I feel now for poking that person in the heart, that cruel jibe that I made me look clever, but I don't really feel good about it. I don't really feel nice about it. Right? So then we run into self-hatred, but that's wrong effort. So in the contemplation, in the mental contemplation of causes and effects, what we're looking at is, well, with this as condition that arises, when I speak in this way, in this cruel, you know, not really grossly cruel, but in this way of humor which puts people down, I get this result of fear and alienation. That's the result. I'm not going to go there. Now that's different than self-hatred. You know, when if I use speech which has hurt someone, even if they didn't take it that way, even if they weren't even listening, you know, it's just a real dumb old blabbing away, weren't even with me, right? I thought it was a great joke, whatever. I would still feel that, wouldn't I? I would still feel that the intention now was not one of harmony or goodness. It was an intention to be a smart ass or to hurt someone or whatever. And that result I need to listen to. I need to listen to that because that result is helping me to awaken in the future. So much of our, a lot of our awakening comes from pain, comes from regret, comes from remorse. But we don't have to hate ourselves. Hating ourselves, this is another form of cruelty. It's more just saying, oh yeah, yeah, when you step over that line, you get this result. So when that line comes up, don't go there. So we start to just remind ourselves of what right speech is, what right effort is. It's not, it's different than saying, I should never step over that line. I'll never do that again. No, it's saying, when that line arises, be careful. You know, be careful, don't go there, don't go there. Because that line will come up again, it does. You know, it's habit. So the line comes up again and I want to maybe give a jab to a person. Oh, there it is. And now I'm mindful of the intention of wrong speech. And now I'm aware, and that's beautiful. It's really beautiful because now I see the full arising of that particular sense of ego thing arising. And I notice it and I don't buy into it. I don't speak it, I don't act on it, and its energy fades, right? And I have a freedom now from not having crossed that line, from not having hurt someone. And that's something, you know, you have to give yourself space to make those mistakes. You have to give yourself space to make a fool of yourself, to put your foot in it, to you know, you just, because we are human. And as much as our intentions are good, the accumulated habits of unskillful intentions are very, very powerful. They're very, very powerful. In terms of mental, the place we go with our minds, those kinds of efforts, they become more and more subtle. So talking to one of the meditators early this morning, in their meditation gets into places which are very quiet and very calm, and there's not much going on. And this person's mind then begins to touch a really deep stillness. And then they get attracted by that deep stillness, and they want to get to that deep stillness, and they make an effort to get to that deep stillness, and they're restless. Right? So sometimes the effort you have to make is the effort to do nothing. Which is incredibly difficult, because as soon as you see, you know, this is in more subtle meditations, as soon as you make the intention, I'm not going to make an effort, you're making an effort. It's an oxymoron, isn't it? But it does come up. It does come up. As you meditate, and if you are a meditator, you'll find your mind begins to settle into a kind of stillness, and there the secret is patience. It's really, and so much of the Buddhist practice is we lack patience. So the mind begins to settle into something very, very peaceful. Is that it? And you've lost it. Because you want something called it. And you don't see that that very perception, is that it, is just a perception. And you move away from the open space of awareness into this sense of, is that it? And you start to look for an it, and the looking for an it is craving, and craving leads to suffering. You attach to it, you give up, and you go have a coffee. And it didn't work. So there's a subtlety of effort too. If I want to, let's say I feel, I was on the other end of the joke. You know, so there was a cruel joke, and I was on the receiving end of that joke. All right? And then I go back to my kuti and say, four letter word. I didn't say it. I swear at the monk or the person, and I notice that. And what comes up is the pleasure of revenge. And revenge can be very pleasurable. So now I'm meditating, I'm thinking, I'm going to set this guy up. I'm going to get them. And that can be quite a nice thought. I'm going to cut him down at his knees next time. Of course it won't work, but the mind likes that. It likes revenge sometimes. And then the good part of me says, oh, I shouldn't have any revenge. I shouldn't be like that. And I get into this horrible argument. Revenge. No. And that doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. So right effort there is to, like, awaken to the very feeling of wanting to hurt someone. And not going there, but not denying that that's a very human feeling. It's very human when you get hurt to want to get back. You know, I think the world has a bit of that going on now, doesn't it? A few wars and all that. So that's a very human kind of feeling to want to do that. And that wanting, unfortunately, has a pleasurable hit to it. Otherwise it wouldn't do it. So it has a certain revenge, a certain kind of pleasurable feeling to it. But it doesn't last for long for most of us because we just get tired of that. And then we go to the other, self-hatred and so on. So this is a more gross kind of effort. So the impulse to hurt or revenge comes up and we say, oh, wow, be careful. Don't follow that. Awaken to that. What does it really feel like to want revenge? And if you can awaken to that, that's a much more powerful feeling. It's in your guts, it's in your body. And you bear witness to that, you eradicate that tendency towards revenge. And that's a kind of purifying effort. So we have, like when I was talking about meditative states of mind, when your mind becomes very silent and still, and you have to be very patient. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to become. Trust this awareness, da-da-da-da-da-da. Takes a lot of patience. This other case, now, this tendency towards revenge has been triggered. Now, you know, it's much more gross, and your effort is much more gross. And your effort is, what does it feel like? Where is the body now? Don't go to thought. Where is it? Where? And you have to really kind of pay attention, really strong pay attention. And that's purification. That happens too, doesn't it? Where something gets triggered in us, which is actually good for us. Those situations of conflict that we can have mindfulness around can be very powerful purification. And the peace of mind that comes from that is surprising. It's very surprising. You go through some horrible, revengeful, lustful, or whatever strong sankhara, and you bear witness to it as just that, as something that's changing, and you bear witness, and you endure it, and you're patient with it, and it goes, and your mind has this peace which you're surprised at. And you realize, oh, maybe that's what the Buddha's talking about. Not the peace of pleasure, but the peace of ending, the peace of purification, the peace of something ceasing. That's experiential. You learn that. And if you trust in that, you don't have to fix it. You don't have to analyze it. You don't have to become a better person even. It's all right to feel these things, but you don't act on them and you don't speak on them. And you don't think those avenues. you begin to just witness to them, you see that that witnessing consciousness, that witnessing of change, is where your peace lies. And you begin to invest a lot into witnessing change. You invest a lot into the awareness of change because you know that is the cause of peace. That is the cause of peace in the future. No matter what your present moment condition is, no matter how difficult it is, your perception of change, the awareness of change, you begin to see, if I can stay with that, that's the pathway. That's the pathway to peace. I think I stopped there. I think the OBS said they want to do a kind of Q&A at 3 o'clock. So if you'd like to stay for the Q&A, please do so.